From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The ivory tower is looking awfully businesslike lately. Big money sports, big corporate dollars in research and consulting. The age of the knowledge economy makes a marriage of academe and business almost irresistible and potentially very lucrative. But behind the wonder drugs and golden fruits of collaboration, keep an eye on the pitfalls, conflicts of interest, secrecy, corruption. Tonight on Point, the university-industrial complex and the deepening bond between academia and big business. We begin with Harvard Medical School's decision to review its policy on how much faculty researchers can profit from their ties with private drug companies. The med school has clung to conservative policies as other institutions have opened wide to corporate dollars. A relaxation would be yet another national signal of falling barriers. I spoke to Katie Mangan, national correspondent for the Chronicle of Higher Education, and asked what larger principles might be at stake here.
Well, a number of medical schools right now are trying to find the right balance in their conflict of interest policies to make sure that researchers are able to work with industry and to help industry commercialize inventions and therapies and medicines that will help the public, but at the same time to do so in a way that doesn't allow research to be tainted by the lure of profit. And there's some concern that researchers who stand to profit from a particular invention or therapy might either withhold information that reflects badly on the product or might just skew the results of their studies.
So all rules changes here are part of a real national conversation. Where has Harvard stood in the kind of spectrum of conservativeness or liberality around rules governing research and relationships with corporations and corporate money?
Well, Harvard Medical School has always had what's considered to be one of the toughest policies or the most restrictive. But Harvard is also a school that others tend to watch very closely. So if Harvard Medical School makes changes in its policy, there's a concern that around the country, other medical schools will be following suit.
Can you describe the basic restrictions that Harvard now puts on its medical school faculty?
Yeah. At Harvard, researchers are not allowed to own more than $20,000 of stock in companies that are actually helping pay for research that they're conducting. They cannot receive more than $10,000 in consulting fees from those companies. And just in terms of the time that they spent on company-sponsored research, that's limited to about 20% or like one in five work days on non-Harvard research.
Katie, do you have any sense of how this compares with guidelines at other universities? Is this much more conservative? Is it in the mainstream?
It's quite a bit more conservative. Some other medical schools, they might have some general guidelines, but nothing quite as specific as this.
In recent years, Harvard has stepped up a couple of times to consider changing these guidelines and has not done so. Why didn't they do it before? What's pushing them to do it now?
A couple of years ago, Harvard considered relaxing some of those rules, and there were a couple of reasons I think they decided not to at that point. One was about 4 years ago at the University of Pennsylvania. A volunteer in a gene therapy trial died, and investigators later learned that at least one of the researchers in that case had financial ties to the company.
It sounds like a kind of cheap novel story, but it actually happened.
It actually did happen. There was a feeling at that point that this isn't the time to be relaxing rules on conflict of interest. If anything, it should be a time to tighten them. So Harvard probably took some heat, too, from other schools when it became known that it was considering relaxing those ties. And I think it may have backed off in part because of some of the outcry from some, especially medical ethicists, who felt that this is the wrong time to be talking about loosening restrictions on conflict of interest rules.
Harvard President Lawrence Summers has been fairly forthright in encouraging the university to loosen the guidelines, encouraging the medical school to get involved with the development of drugs that might save lives or cure diseases. Is this typical for university administration to be pushing reluctant medical school and other deans on these guidelines?
You know, I'm really not sure to what extent university presidents have been pressuring medical school deans, but I do know that the deans in many cases are under pressure from their faculty. At Harvard, I understand a number of faculty members have felt that their policies were too restrictive and that there was a concern that some faculty might either leave or that Harvard might have trouble recruiting faculty if they knew that they could make money off their research.
And there is very large money at stake here, I assume.
Yeah, there's a lot of money at stake, which, you know, many people would see as part of the problem, that there is a temptation to spend an awful lot of time doing industry-sponsored research and potentially skewing the results of that research in order to make a profit.
The Boston Globe broke the latest news of Harvard reconsidering its guidelines, and it quoted the former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, Marcia Engel, today saying that they would be unwise to loosen the restrictions. They should actually tighten the restrictions. What's that about?
There are a number of people who feel that this is a time, especially when medical schools around the country are looking to Harvard for guidance and for setting an example, that this is a time when medical educators need to be making the point that they want to avoid any conflict of interest and to make sure that the research is sound.
Katie Mangan, if there's a tension here, which I hear you describing between academic integrity and big money, which is winning currently?
It's very hard to say. It depends on who you ask. I mean, there's certainly a lot of ethicists who would argue that big money is winning and that, in fact, much of the research that's being done is tainted by the desire of the researchers involved to make money off of their research.
And on the other hand, you hear college officials saying, if we don't make these relationships, we won't bring drugs to market.
Yeah, and especially at a time when there is reduced federal funding for research, a lot of people say that medical schools really need money from pharmaceutical and other companies, that they have to ensure that those relationships continue and thrive, that they can't afford to say no to industry.
We can just imagine the pressure. Katie Mangan, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Katie Mangan is national correspondent for the Chronicle of Higher Education. She spoke to me from Austin, Texas. We're talking tonight about the growing commercialization of the American university, opportunities and pressures to produce new profits, pressures that may eat away at old ideals. In a forthright new book, Universities in the Marketplace, former Harvard president Derek Bok sounds an alarm about universities going too far down the corporate collaboration path to fame and fortune. Universities, he warns, share one characteristic with compulsive gamblers and exiled royalty. There is never enough money to satisfy their desires. What can seem like a dream come true, says Bok, could be a university's worst nightmare. What's gained and what's lost when academic institutions and big business cozy up? Can truth and independence survive the proximity and infusion of corporate megabucks? In a knowledge economy, doesn't there need to be a close relationship between industry and universities? Where should, how can the line be drawn? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight in the studio is Derek Bok. From 1971 to 1991, he served as president of Harvard University. His new book is Universities in the Marketplace, the Commercialization of Higher Education. Good evening and welcome, Derek Bok.
Nice to be here.
Very nice to have you. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire tonight is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Mr. Bok.
Hi.
Derek Bok, take us in here. You write about something of irreplaceable value that is at risk of being lost in what you call the relentless growth of commercialization in the university setting in America. What is at risk?
Well, the risk is that bit by bit, we will do things which will compromise the basic values of higher education, the integrity and objectivity of our research, the standards that we employ in educating students and at deciding whom to admit to our campuses. And as you do that, you're in danger of losing the confidence of the public, which is very important. If people don't trust the education that universities provide because they think there's a profit motive, this is certainly going to impair the process of teaching and learning. But also, apart from the public trust, which is very important for our institutions, the values, the core values of universities are really essential to maintaining the kind of morale and commitment and loyalty of faculty members and making sure that academic life continues to be a true calling and not just a way of making a living.
Not just another
way to make a buck. You spent many years in the seat of a college president at a rather prominent university. Can you describe the pressures that then and now come on to college administrators, and for that matter, college faculty, to compromise, to commercialize, to get in harness with corporate America? How does it work? How do the pressures come to bear?
Well, you do start with this constant need for more resources for a very good and understandable reason. A good university is just filled with creative people, and creative people always have new and interesting and useful things to do, and those things almost always cost money. And so that, plus the tremendous competition for prestige in the United States, drives universities to need more money. And then universities find themselves today in this rather unusual position that they are the primary source in our society for the three ingredients that are most important to progress: highly trained people, expert knowledge, and new discoveries.
So this is really the knowledge economy formula.
That's right. And all of that is increasingly valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And so if it were clear that universities should simply be an ivory tower and pay no attention to the outside world but just do their teaching and research, it would be comparatively easy. It would just be a question of mustering the will to do that. But, of course, that's not the case. Universities ought to be much engaged with the outside world and make a very sincere effort to try to facilitate the spread of their knowledge so that it can be turned into useful products and processes. The trick is how to do that in a way that doesn't compromise basic values, because if you don't do that, in the long run, universities will become less effective and they won't be even as much value to business, let alone to the rest of society.
You write about the risks inherent in those commercial relationships. As we sit here tonight, how hypothetical is this, or how real? Do you see these risks emerging, playing out? Do you see them not only as risks, but, you know, do we have a problem here, Dirk Bach?
Well, I think the most interesting way of looking at that question is to examine the case of intercollegiate athletics. Now, many people say, why are you bringing that in, of all things, when you're talking about these very serious matters of education research? But athletics is the oldest form of commercialization, mm-hmm. so you can really see what's happened when you let the thing go for a long period of time. And if you examine big-time athletics, you find that your admission standards have been compromised. You're letting in athletes with credentials far below those of the rest of the students. You're watering down the curriculum, easier courses, repeated instances of scandal of various kinds. So essential values have really given way. And the purpose of my book was simply to try to point out how this was already beginning to occur in education and research, and looking to athletics as a kind of warning that if we don't pay great attention and figure out how to draw careful lines and limits, we could make compromises again, which once you get to a certain point become irreversible. You can't climb back.
Jack Beattie, we like to think of college sports in a different category from what goes on in the labs and the classrooms. But Dirk Bach is saying, watch out, what's happened with the commercialization of college sports can happen to the entire project.
Yeah, and when you think about the model, I mean, you could say that the college athletics is a kind of, at least in big colleges, is a sort of franchise of the professional leagues. This is how they get, increasingly baseball even gets many, if not most of its players from university subsidization and university education. So it's comparable to a Novartis, big Swiss pharmaceutical giant, basically buying the Berkeley botany department and saying anything you people discover goes to us, and that's the way it's going to be. And we've gotten used to it. We've certainly gotten used to athletics, and that's a frightening model of how natural it seems that there should be, you know, the Big Ten and the rest.
Well, there it is. We're talking tonight with former Harvard President Dirk Bach about the risk of commercialization eating away at fundamental values of American higher education. We're looking at the university industrial complex and the deepening bond between academia and big business. You can join the conversation. How much green are you comfortable seeing around the Ivy Tower? What's gained and what's lost when big business moves into the halls, the labs of academe? What are you seeing in your school? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the university industrial complex and the deepening bond between academia and big business. Our guest tonight is Derek Bach, former president of Harvard University, author of the new book, Universities in the Marketplace, The Commercialization of Higher Education. You can join the conversation. What are you seeing in your school? Is the corporate academic marriage working or not? Can truth and independence survive the influence of big corporate dollars? Do you have the same confidence in a university research if you know it's been paid for by a private corporation? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Derek Bach, you describe how university athletics have essentially, in many quarters, become kind of bought and paid for undertakings that work back upstream into the campus, undermining values, undermining standards. Take us in to the world of, let's say, research. Scientific research seems to be the most on point in this knowledge economy. Where do you see the threats, the erosion there? You write in your book about issues of secrecy, of conflict of interest, of even what I take as a kind of corruption of research. Give us some examples of what concerns you there.
Well, I think you've named the most prominent ones. Most companies that give money for research are naturally concerned that the fruits of those research don't find their way into the hands of their competitors, and which would obviously benefit their competitors, and yet they would have paid the money for the research. So they impose requirements of secrecy. And that's fine and understandable and a price worth paying to get the research done. But companies often go further and further in asking for secrecy over longer periods of time and in more comprehensively, to the point where you could really seriously interfere with the free exchange of ideas in departments among colleagues with students.
Well, just
and
on
so,
that point, let's roll it back even to your first comment there. Is in a university setting where open sharing has been the tradition, hasn't it? Isn't even a
definitely.
Little bit of secrecy a kind of impingement on the free flow of ideas that the university system is supposed to support? Or am I being naive there? Has there always been secrecy?
Well, I think it is an infringement, and that shows what's so difficult about these problems. It is an infringement of the kind of complete openness that you would like, but you have to balance that against the desirability of being able to do the research with industrial support, and then, because of that support, get the results quickly in the hands of companies that can make useful products and
so
processes.
So
it's a problem of
there.
Striking a balance.
And conflict of interest?
Conflict of interest occurs where your researchers or even the institution itself has a financial interest in the outcome of the research, so that there is some reason either to lose objectivity and be biased in favor of your funder, or as the public comes to know about this, the public may at least suspect that the research is biased.
But the drug is not as safe as the research contends.
That's right. And if you think about it, in a democracy, it's enormously important that there be impartial sources of information that people can believe in. And if people begin to think, well, you never know if these professors are in the pocket of some company that's funding them, that degree of confidence is lost, and something essential to democracy goes with it.
So I'm still trying to get a feeling from you, Derek Bach, about where things stand now, how far down this road American universities are. And I realize it's not universal. You can't say one thing for every school. There are different degrees. But how much of a problem, how much, I don't know, corruption or whatever you want to call it, of the ideal do you see as extant already?
Well, there are a lot of research contracts that either explicitly or implicitly allow secrecy for substantial periods beyond what is really necessary to protect the corporation's interests.
Closing down a free dialogue about whole areas of science.
That's right. and so that you maintain secrecy instead of just a couple of months necessary to decide whether you want to file a patent. The secrecy is imposed for 6 months or 8 months or a year.
And this isn't hypothetical. This is a real problem.
That's fairly
now.
Widespread. Mm-hmm. There's also quite a number of instances of conflict of interest where researchers have substantial financial relationships with the companies that are funding their research. I don't want to say it happens all the time, mm-hmm. but it certainly is not an isolated occurrence mm-hmm. either. Mm-hmm. And most universities do not have particularly strict rules to keep that within manageable limits. Mm-hmm. The worst thing you have is occasionally when you have what we call high-stakes research, where you have research that the outcome of which is going to affect entire industries, as, let's say, the anti-smoking research did, or is going to decide whether a product is really effective or not, a new drug, for example. The stakes are very high, and therefore the temptations get to be very great for companies to try to influence the research a little bit so it's more likely to come out in their favor.
Which sounds mild when you say it, but when big universities or any universities begin to do that, that is a kind of fundamental corruption. Jack Beatty, come in here. We see, on the one hand, a knowledge economy absolutely would blossom with the kind of fuel that university minds and research can offer. But Derek Bach is pointing to the kind of fundamental values that created all that that respect and learning in the American university system and their vulnerability once these relationships get made.
Yes, I mentioned the case of Berkeley and the botany school. It's not called that. It's called something else. But there, I've read the Atlantic Monthly published an article called The Kept University, which said that these faculty there just basically, some of them couldn't talk about subjects to outsiders. They essentially had forfeited the freedom of mind that is supposed to be definitive of the university in order to get Novartis's subsidy. This is really a scary proposition, and this is at a public university. You know, I can imagine trends in the world today bringing about a state of affairs such that 20 years from now, someone like President Bach could write another book called University Incorporated, telling how all this happened. And, you know, he could point to no federal money for research or drying up. I mean, really, let's face it, with the budget crises ahead of us, it's going to be much less that. Mm-hmm. Skyrocketing tuitions that essentially are going to push the university, the private university, back to what it was when my father was a boy, which was something only rich people do. And then state budget crises, something like 34 states have unsustainable financial futures. They simply can't go on the structures they have. Something will have to give. And then into that, within the university, you've got this tremendous crisis in authority where university departments can't put knowledge in a hierarchy. They can't justify the old basis of liberal education anymore, which is this is what you need to know to be a liberally educated person. Instead, it's choose whatever you want. We can't make a priority out of our knowledge. So they've abrogated their authority of knowledge. Along comes the checkbook. Along comes the corporation. We'll deal with the budget. We'll deal with the authority. Instead of having education, we'll have training. Your kid can get a job.
And there you go. And in comes commercialization. Derek Bach is up with his hand for that one.
Well, I just want to sound a quick note to balance the discussion a little mm-hmm. bit. Mm-hmm. After 20 years of dealing with these problems, I don't want to deny their seriousness, but I came away absolutely convinced that a university administration that is alert to these dangers and determined to keep them within bounds can do so. In other words, you can keep excessive secrecy and conflict of interest and all these other dangers from occurring and still maintain a very healthy, active relationship with academic science.
Are we nationally on a path toward that balance in your view, or are we drifting towards something not so attractive?
I'm obviously worried about the drift, or I wouldn't have mm-hmm. written the book, but I also think it's quite possible to correct that. And I think it should be added that there are a number of companies out there that share the university's interest in having effective universities that are not tainted by these problems, because in the long run, everybody suffers if universities become, their standards are compromised, the public loses faith in them, and so forth. So the situation is far from hopeless, but it certainly requires constant vigilance.
Derek Bach, Jack Beatty, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Pasadena, California, Larry Gilbert. He's Director of Technology Transfer at Caltech, has over 30 years' experience in university technology licensing, and is a licensed patent attorney. Good evening and welcome, Larry Gilbert.
Well, thank you, and hello to all you out there. I guess it's about 8:30 where you are, 5:30 where I am.
Yeah, Larry Gilbert, let me ask you, you're in charge of tech transfer out there. Are you doing God's work, or are you corrupting the system?
That's a nice way to put things, I suppose. Clearly, we're hopefully doing something in between. I don't know that we're doing God's work, but certainly university is a mission. Their mission, among other things, is to confer a benefit to the public. And as I scanned Derek Bach's book, clearly I think the basic proposition that he says, that he cites, is that commercialization may confer a public benefit, but he points out that its excesses are of concern and require that universities should set appropriate limits. I don't disagree with that in principle. However, I disagree with some of the things he says specifically.
Such as?
If we look at secrecy, he has referred to one particular study in the statements that he's, in which he repeatedly states that there is an increased degree of secrecy because of corporate research. I have not experienced that in all of the time that I've been involved in research agreements. First of all, if we look at publication delay, on average, for most universities, that's 60 days. It's rare. There may be some universities that might grant you 6 months or a year, but I think that's rare. At Caltech, it's 0 days, although for a faculty member, if they wish, it can be 30 days.
So you're saying info is not being bottled up. Research results are not being bottled up. Don't companies ask you to keep it under wraps for a while out there, Larry Gilbert?
Well, of course they're going to ask for it, but in order to get the research done, it's a matter of give and take with respect to publication and with respect to what kind of rights they're going to get. Those are the two major issues.
Let me put this question to you. Once a university has a big gravy train coming in from the corporate world, how does, to Derek Bach's concern about public opinion, how can the public then presume that there's integrity, that there's uprightness, that there's independence and honesty here? Does the relationship itself kind of bring with it a suspicion that, you know, as you speak to us tonight, you no doubt have a whole lot of big contracts out there for all kinds of things that we'd probably like to have in the economy, but how can we maintain confidence that things aren't bought and paid for, that you're speaking to us from a disinterested point of view that we once would have called academic, but now there's a profit piece attached?
Well, first of all, I think you have to look at the situation in terms of overall context, in terms of how much corporate research really is going on amongst universities. MIT is the biggest player, and that represents maybe something like 25% of its research. At Caltech, it's much smaller.
Mm-hmm.
The number of big contracts are really relatively small. There aren't that many. You mentioned the one at Berkeley. I'm not familiar with the exact details because I'm not privy to that agreement. But the university system in California is very strict about publication delay and openness and all of that. So I would find it very difficult to believe that the Novartis agreement ties up what's going on there and keeps it secret.
So you're seeing something marginal here and something not affecting the big values. But we're talking with Larry Gilbert at Caltech tonight. Derek Bach is with us. Jack Beatty, stand by. I want to turn to our callers. Mark is calling from Darlington, Wisconsin. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening there.
Good evening.
I think this is a real important topic, and I'm glad that you've decided to address this tonight. I'm a faculty member in one of the larger public university systems here in Wisconsin, and I think there's a huge academic integrity problem that's been connected now for a long time with corporate influence and corporate money. And you've already addressed some of the problems with the science. And by the way, my view is that anybody who's still denying the problem of secrecy is either bought into the system in some way or else it just hasn't been paying attention. But I'd like to bring up the issue that was touched on by Jack earlier, and that is the question of the curriculum and the priorities and structure of the curriculum. And what I've seen in the UW system is that to the extent that corporate money is increasingly central to the funding, and that's accomplished through defunding by right-wingers in the legislature, the basic curriculum is being skewed away from the liberal arts, philosophy, humanities, that kind of thing, and towards the more commercial wings of the campus, the business programs, other professional, so-called professional programs, engineering, and so on.
So science and business win, and who loses, Mark?
Science loses. The only people that are winning anything, and what they're winning are more luxuriously furnished classrooms and offices, are the business sector and other sort of what I would call commercial wings of campus.
You say science loses, you say, you mean
science loses through secrecy.
Oh, I see.
Among other things. And also the corrupting of the falsification of the research. I mean, this has been well documented in the nation and other places. Anybody who denies this now is really needs to get a reality check.
So this is not hypothetical. In your world, it's happening, and you don't like what you see. Mark, thanks for your call. Derek Bach?
I would like to. Well, go ahead.
One moment, Larry. I mean, here you see it. The voice from the public university system says, hey, this is happening all around me. To Derek Bach first, this is reallocating resources. We're seeing some parts of the university starved and others better fed, but maybe corrupted at the same time.
No, I think we have to distinguish very carefully between two things. One is a relationship with business that has to be managed very carefully so that it doesn't get out of hand. Mm-hmm. I think what the last caller was bringing up was another very important force, but one that's extremely difficult to resist, and that is that the curriculum is obviously going to respond to where the jobs are. And it's not a matter of people in the legislature manipulating it. It's a fact that students are terribly concerned about getting jobs. They're going to gravitate to departments where they think they can get training that's going to equip them for jobs in an uncertain world. In order to get faculty who, the ones who are closer to commercial enterprise, you're going to have to pay more to get them because they have other options. And so in many different ways, the priorities of the university do get to be somewhat skewed.
Are you saying it's ever been thus? Sector. Is that your point, Derek?
No, I think it's more so today than it has been before, but it's inevitably that way. I don't see what the university can do about that. The reason I wrote the book that I did is because I do think there's a lot that we can do to make sure that our relationships with business are kept within healthy bounds and not allowed to go the route of intercollegiate athletics.
Larry Gilbert, Derek Bach, Jack Beattie, stand by. We're talking tonight about the university industrial complex and the deepening bond between academia and big business. You can join the conversation in the knowledge economy is a tight university-business relationship necessary. Are the gains here worth the risk to integrity? Can we have both? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
And make a bid for the news.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the university industrial complex and the deepening bond between academia and big business. My guests are former Harvard University President Derek Bach, president there from 1971 to 1991, author of the new book, Universities in the Marketplace, and from Pasadena, California, Larry Gilbert, director of technology transfer at Caltech. You can join the conversation as well in a competitive, global knowledge economy. Does America have a choice not to marry academia and business? What are the risks here? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Larry Gilbert, you were looking to respond to our caller from Wisconsin who said he saw corruption around him.
Well, I would submit, based on his comments, that he's neither a researcher nor has he ever been exposed to a research agreement. I personally have negotiated literally hundreds of research agreements, all of which deal with what you're referring to as secrecy.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, a company wants to get the best bargain it can, but for the most part, there are limits that universities are willing to do and grant, and it may well have been true that you could delay publication for longer periods of time in the past. I don't believe that's true today, nor is I believe it's been true for some time.
And yet our caller Mark is in the system, so we're listening to what he's saying. Bernard is calling from Boston. Hi, Bernard. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm Bernard. I'm a doctor. I'm into the cardiovascular medicine area.
All right.
I'm also a new author. My background is that you know, I have training in Central America, the Caribbean, and England.
All right.
I'm here up at the Harvard-based institution in Boston. I want to just quote from the former editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association, because my focus is on the impact on the area of medicine and medical education and medical research.
Take us straight to it, Bernard.
Okay. 7 out of 10 Americans die from lifestyle-related diseases. The bulk of these are preventable diseases, yet the current attitude towards treating these diseases is to treat them with high-tech, high pharmaceutical-type treatments.
So, Bernard, how does this, in your mind, figure into a relationship between business and academia, or does it?
Because the entire direction of medicine is focused on treating diseases with very little attention being paid to prevention, and this is...
Because treatment is where the money is, you're
yes,
saying.
The money is in the medicine.
And
right?
So you're pointing to a more insidious...
There's nothing fundamentally wrong with treating diseases. We all need that.
Yeah.
But the crisis of healthcare in America right now is directly... As a matter of fact, the whole emergence of the HMOs, the managed mm-hmm. cost system, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. is actually a managed cost system. It was in response to the fact that the whole direction of medicine is into more drugs, more technology, more treatment.
Bernard, let us run just with that, because it's a big point. Derek Bach, first to you. What about it? Can there be this insidious effect that, you know, to a hammer, everything is a nail? To a university system or a research system that is profit-oriented, research that leads to products and profits is the appropriate research to be done?
I don't think it's quite as dire as that. I agree that... the overwhelming amount of research money has gone into finding cures. I don't think that's primarily the result of business. I think that's been a matter of government policy for a very long time, to pay far more attention, let's say, to trying to find a cure for cancer than to try to find out why people get addicted to smoking.
But might it lead to an approach that looks for drugs instead of, I don't know, alternate lifestyles, that puts more emphasis on the things that can be commodified?
I think that's right, but I think that priority really came into existence much more through government policy than through corporations. I do think that although there's still a great imbalance, as the caller pointed out, I think we've made a good deal of improvement about concentrating now on lifestyle, on prevention, and so I think the public is far more aware of the values of preventive medicine than they used to be. So perhaps there's a little momentum going in the other direction, and maybe mm-hmm. we can restore a healthier balance if we continue that, and if universities continue as ours has to try to really emphasize School of Public Health, the Department of Preventive Medicine, other aspects of medical education that focus on the preventive side and not just the high-tech, expensive cure of disease was already contracted.
Mm-hmm. David's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've actually been on both sides of this. I was at a university, and I'm now in industry. I think it's kind of hypocritical. I think the colleges have really done this to themselves. There's a strong focus, I think, on research funding as opposed to scholarship. And, in fact, teaching has been had undue has not had the proper emphasis. In the real focus is on the number of dollars in the door.
So, David, for those of us not inside, you're saying that somehow anything related to research funding is pulled up, and if it's just straight old-fashioned teaching, it falls down in priority?
Well, I'm saying that when you're selecting a professor to give tenure to, mm-hmm. the focus is on dollars, not on the quality of teaching.
You mean the dollars that professor could bring into the institution?
And, you know, so if I'm a professor at a university, what is my focus going to be? If I can get money, I'll get money from whatever source I can get it. And now for academia to moan about the compromising the idea was compromised as soon as the focus was taken off of teaching and put on dollars.
Larry Gilbert, let me put that to you. Obviously, there's a high premium on research, but research is also what I guess brings in the big dollars. Teaching undergraduates, maybe not so much. Does it shift the emphasis in a way that's damaging, or is this, again, does this go to American competitiveness and kind of inevitability in a knowledge economy?
Well, I think that, first of all, many universities such as Caltech, MIT, Harvard are research institutions, and clearly as a consequence of being a research institution, much of what's done is focused on research as well as teaching.
But they're not solely research institutions, obviously.
But there are many universities that are there only to teach and not do research. So in the case of a research institution, it has to do both. And to some extent, it may have to compromise to some extent in order to do both as well as it can. And there will have to be decisions made and compromises made as a consequence of that. And it is probably true that that tenure is somewhat based on the ability to get research dollars. If you cannot, you may have to move on and perhaps do your teaching somewhere else. But that's simply a fact of life when you chose to go to a research institution in the first place.
Jack Beatty, you can hear the wheels grinding here tonight. On the one hand, God knows the American economy needs the brain power in its universities. At the same time, once that money gets its nose under the tent, in terms of old-time values, how do you avoid corruption?
Well, I mean, I think President Bok's point about athletics is so well taken here. I mean, my gosh, look at what we stand for there. And the same values are corrupted. I talked to somebody at Ohio State about their athletic, what they spend on their athletic fields and parks and the rest. He just described the locker room there. I mean, my gosh, he could have been talking about the Taj Mahal. They compete one with another, not just in the in sending coaches to pick up their applicants, the people are trying to woo, but in the, you know, is it a Lincoln Continental or is it a? In other words, this is. We've accepted that, and if we've taken it, and sometimes even for the same reason, I mean, money. After all, what's athletics about but alumni giving? So that's what really scares me, that the canary is already just basically dead in that mine.
And yet the economy needs this research, Jack.
It certainly does, but, you know, at what point does intellectual activity get converted into intellectual capital? And how does that affect the nature of the knowledge, not just in making it exclusive, but does it also narrow it? Does it also prevent the kind of, you know, disinterested inquiry I've read that really leads to fundamental scientific discovery?
Well, there's something for all Americans to be watching, and we're glad to have the chance to raise it tonight. Derek Bok, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Derek Bok is former president of Harvard University and author of Universities in the Marketplace, The Commercialization of Higher Education. And Larry Gilbert, director of technology transfer at Caltech, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Jack, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, the latest on the monkeypox scare in the Midwest. This is On Point. A rare virus now detected for the first time in the Americas is the likely cause of illness in more than 30 people in three Midwestern states, the Centers for Disease Control confirmed yesterday. Monkeypox is the latest infectious disease to make news, following SARS and West Nile virus into the headlines. A less deadly cousin of smallpox, public health experts believe monkeypox was spread by prairie dogs. Dr. Mark Wegner is chief of the Communicable Diseases and Epidemiology section at the Wisconsin Department of Public Health. He says people in his state are concerned about monkeypox, but he believes public health officials will be able to control the spread of the disease.
Monkeypox is a virus that is related to smallpox, but is a less lethal virus. Symptoms that it causes are a rash that can be very similar to a rash that is seen in smallpox. What we've been seeing in the people in Wisconsin that have been suspect or confirmed cases of monkeypox have been fevers, rash, swollen lymph nodes, and then chills and drenching sweat. As far as whether or not people need to be concerned about monkeypox, what we have found in our investigation is that anyone who is ill has had distinct contact with an ill prairie dog or an animal that has had contact with an ill prairie dog and then became ill. At this point, there are a limited amount of people that are actually involved. It was first recognized in about 1970, and it was described as a distinct virus from smallpox. And it is mostly in Western and Central African countries in rainforests. That's where we've seen it in the past. We have never seen, as far as our knowledge, a documented case of monkeypox in the United States. We've been able to trace the distribution chain to a distributor in Illinois who'd gotten the animals from a distributor in Texas. There was an ill Gambian rat that was shipped with these prairie dogs that we're looking at. And that is one of the things that is a possible source of this initial infection, possibly that Gambian rat could have infected these prairie dogs. Mostly, from what is known of the virus in nature in Africa, mostly transmission from animals to humans. Certainly more difficult to transmit this human to human than it would be for something like smallpox. And basically, what we've known from prior literature about this illness is that if there is human-to-human transmission, it does not continue to propagate in the manner that smallpox transmission would, where it would continue to transmit from person to person. Usually, if there is a human-to-human transmission chain, it eventually dies out, and the virus can't sustain infection in humans beyond a few infections. Well, as far as have we been receiving reports from the general public, we have received a few, which we would expect that once this receives a lot more exposure throughout the state and even nationally, that more people would start to be aware, and then symptoms that they might not have really attributed to anything else in the past, they may now think, oh, I actually did have a contact with a sick animal, and that might trigger them to seek care. Some people have called us, some people seek care with their physician, and that's what we would recommend, is that if anyone has a question about them possibly being infected, that they would seek care with a medical provider. People are certainly concerned and calling in. A lot of people do call to maybe get some reassurance or to get a better idea of what is going on, but I haven't noticed any heightened level. As far as spread throughout the nation, we've been working with the CDC, of course, and then within the state with the Department of Agriculture, our local health departments, our state laboratory of hygiene, and just making sure that we are trying to track down all these animals. If there are any ill individuals, that we identify them quickly and isolate them on the chance that there would be some kind of human-to-human transmission, which we haven't seen yet. We've also put in place in Wisconsin an emergency order that bans the importation, sale or distribution and display or any other activity that could result in direct human contact of prairie dogs that are involved here. So we're doing everything that we can to make sure that we are controlling this, and we learned about it early and have been putting in control measures in place since that time.
Dr. Mark Wegner is chief of the Communicable Diseases and Epidemiology section at the Wisconsin Department of Public Health. He spoke to us from Madison about monkeypox. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, in Gregorian Oriental.